All right, well, let's get started. My name is Rich Holdeman. I'm the pastor at the RP Church in Bloomington, Indiana. I'm also a faculty member at Indiana University. I'm a lecturer there. I got my PhD at IU in cell and molecular biology, and I've been teaching in the biology department for the last 15 years, teaching things like cell biology, genetics, and a little bit of disease biology. I am not a medical doctor. So I'm not giving you professional medical advice. I will do my best at the end of this talk to take questions, but I pretty much guarantee I won't be able to answer everybody's question, but I'll do my best. I hope that as we spend some time talking about this issue, we'll all learn something. Toward that end, why don't we begin our time with a word of prayer? Let's pray together. Dear Lord, we ask that you'd be with us in this hour, that you would guide us and help our thinking. We pray, Lord, that you would give us wisdom as parents, particularly who have children and have responsibilities for them. We ask that you would guide us, and we pray that this talk would be enlightening and that you would help us to get our questions answered and that you'd be with us in our time together. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. When I first suggested doing a talk like this, one of the organizers said, "Are you crazy?" Gary Larson, who always has some insightful things for us, shows us Hal with a real bummer of a birthmark there. Now, Hal received that sort of as a quirk of his birth, and so in some sense I've chosen to paint one of those on myself and done it voluntarily. You should know, though, I am not doing this talk because I like to argue. It's not why. I realize that people who have opinions on this issue tend to hold them very strongly, and so that may include some of you in the audience, but I'm not here to argue with you. That's not my objective. I am concerned, though, because there is a lot of confusing information out and available, and I am aware that people are making decisions based on information that is not good information. So when I'm doing this talk, I'm assuming at least two things about you, and especially if you're a parent or grandparent. The first is I'm assuming about you that you love your kids and you want what's best for them. So if anything I say in here offends you, do not take it that I question your motives. I don't. I believe every parent in here wants to see what's best for their children. The second thing that I'm assuming about you is that if you are presented with good information, you will change your mind, potentially, if it needs to be changed. In other words, I'm presenting information to you with the idea that we're open-minded about the topic, that we're willing to be educated about the topic, which sort of goes back to number one. I know that in the population at large, there's a small percentage that will not change their view on this. I don't think whatever happened. And I'm not assuming that about you. I'm assuming that if we present good information, we're going to respond to it. My desire is to give godly counsel in love. I'm a pastor, and I look at this issue pastorally, and I think hopefully this will be helpful not only to the people who have kids in the room or thinking about this, but to pastors who might be in a position to advise others about the issue. And then finally, I'm doing this because it's a serious issue. And the decisions you make on this issue have consequences and may have very serious consequences. So it's not a trivial issue, and I think it's worth spending some time talking about it. So here is my plan. We'll look at a number of questions as we work through the material. And I've given you sort of the skeleton of the talk in your outline. What are vaccines? How do they work? Are they safe? Are vaccines effective? Why are vaccines controversial? What's a proper Christian response? Where can I find good resources? And then, Lord willing, we'll have some time for questions at the end. If it seems tight at the end, it's not because I'm intentionally filibustering. Just a lot of things to cover here. All right, let's take up the first topic then. What are vaccines? I didn't give you a ton of information in the outline because I don't want to overwhelm you with info, but if you you can jot down some notes if you need to. So a simple description of a vaccine is a way to provide immunity that comes from getting an infection without the negative consequences of getting the infection. And the reason vaccines work is because the way God has designed our immune system. Our immune systems are one of the most amazing things about our bodies. So the immune system has three characteristics that make it unique and incredibly effective. First of all, your immune system has the ability to respond to an almost limitless variety of challenges to it. So there's diversity in your system. And estimates are that you could respond to something like 100 billion unique challenges, far more than you would actually face in the world. Secondly, your immune system has the ability to respond specifically to each pathogen. So not only do you respond to a wide variety of things, but your body can respond specifically to the particular pathogen that's infecting your body. And then thirdly, your immune system has memory. In other words, the second time your body sees a particular pathogen, it responds much more effectively. It remembers that it's seen a pathogen before. Now, the cost of having an immune system like this is time. Because your body is able to recognize a great variety of threats, sometimes there's a lag in the time it takes to identify the particular threat that you're facing at the moment. This lag time can give a pathogen the opportunity to multiply and establish an infection in your body before your body mounts an effective response to it. I'm going to give you a couple of terms here. I put these in the outline. These are helpful. I've tried to avoid doing this very often, but these are helpful just in terms of thinking about how vaccines work. So antibodies are proteins made by your body and are a key component of your immune system. What I'm giving you is going to be pretty simplified. So antibodies are proteins. They're in these sort of Y shapes. And antibodies have, at the end here of the Y, a particular shape that's able to bind to molecules that match it. So we call molecules that are bound by antibodies antigens. And for the purposes of this lecture, you can think of an antigen as a foreign protein. Okay, so here in this picture, right, this antibody has a green color here just to indicate it'll bind to the green circle, but it won't bind to the yellow triangle. And that's each antibody that you make has a very distinctive shape and will bind to a distinctive pathogen. Just to give you an idea, why shapes? This is a rendering of a flu virus. And a flu virus really only has two unique shapes on its surface, but you see they're quite pronounced. And so you'd have antibodies in your body that would recognize a particular version of the flu virus. But it's shapes that match each other. Okay, so as I said, since you have a great variety of antibodies, it'll take some time before the antibody that recognizes that specific pathogen will bind to it. Once that pathogen is recognized by the properly shaped antibody, you trigger an immune response. And that leads to the production of many, many more cells that are producing antibodies that recognize that particular pathogen. Okay, so that's how, there's a lag here. So sometimes you're going to have symptoms in a sickness until your body can respond. After the pathogen is defeated, right, so either you die or your immune system eventually takes care of this, the pathogen, your body is going to retain more of the cells that produced antibodies that recognize that particular pathogen. And so if that particular pathogen returns, it will be recognized more quickly the second time around, and your immune system will mount a significantly quicker response and a stronger response. Thus, your body may be functionally protected from a reoccurrence of the disease. So that's a very simple overview of how this works. I put this figure in your outline. I'm not going to go through it now, but this just sort of summarizes exactly what I've just described. that here is an antibody-producing cell called a B cell. It can only recognize particularly shaped pathogen. When it does, it's activated. It makes many more copies. Some of these copies produce tons of antibodies to bind up the bacteria, the invader. These are then gobbled up. And then you've got these memory cells that are staying circulating in your body that'll be there ready to respond much more rapidly the next time that pathogen comes around. Okay, so continuing then, what are vaccines? A vaccine is a way to expose your immune system to the antigens found on the pathogen without having to fight the pathogen itself, because there are often a lot of negative side effects when your body's fighting a pathogen. Edward Jenner, an English doctor, demonstrated the efficacy of vaccination in 1796 when he used cowpox to inoculate a young boy against the smallpox disease. Now, Jenner did not invent vaccination. Vaccination was going on for most of the 1700s, and it probably, we think, started maybe in Istanbul. At least we know that that's where it got brought from the east to the west. Because what people would do would recognize this horrible disease, smallpox. People who got a mild case of it were protected from later getting a more severe case of it. So when a mild case was going around, they would actually take, because this would cause scabs on your arms and things, they would take pus or scabs from someone who had a mild case and put that into a healthy person, and that would protect them. So that had gone on for quite a while. Jenner was the first person who sort of did any experiments to demonstrate that this worked. And in this case, based on some observations, milkmaids would sometimes get on their hands cowpox, which is a pox disease affecting cows, and just minimally causing problems with humans. And so these milkmaids claimed that they never got the smallpox. And so he does this experiment where he takes pus from a milkmaid who's got a few blisters on her hand, puts it into the arm of an 8-year-old boy, with the mother's consent. This painting is meant to represent the mother is there. So the boy got a small rash on his arm and felt kind of tired, had a little fever for a few days, but recovered nicely. Then Jenner went back and exposed the boy to actual smallpox the way they used to, and he did not respond. He did that experiment twice, and the boy did not have any problems with smallpox. So thus, vaccination was born. Now, over the years, the smallpox vaccine was developed, and it was a different virus other than the cowpox was used ultimately, and this became widely used. Most of us have no idea what smallpox was like. This disease is thought by many to have killed more people in the world than any other disease. As I say there, somewhere between 300 and 500 million people killed by this disease, and that's in the 20th century alone. There are estimates that in the 1700s and 1800s, every year, smallpox killed something like a tenth of the population of the world. This disease caused rabies. And it didn't just kill people quietly. Literally, the virus goes into the skin and separates the layers of the skin. And that can happen internally as well as externally, as you see here. And although it only killed something like 30% of its victims on average, it left many people permanently disfigured or blinded. Smallpox is an incredible story because by the late 1970s, it had been completely eradicated in nature. Still, smallpox exists in some research laboratories, the virus does. But there haven't been any human cases, natural cases, since 1977. This is due to widespread use of the smallpox vaccination. Okay, so how do vaccines work? I've said a little bit about this already. Let's say a little bit more. Vaccines allow your immune system to see a version of the pathogen that is not dangerous. When you have that kind of thing going on, projectile sneezing, right? You're dealing with the effects of the pathogen. And this is actually a strategy by the pathogen, because the pathogen knows, right? It doesn't have a brain, but I speak this way just so we understand. The pathogen has a limited time to survive in your body before your body wipes it out. So its job is to multiply as much as it can and then get out. And this is how this particular pathogen getting out to another host. Okay, so there are a number of ways then to make a non-pathogenic version of a pathogen. I'll run through these pretty quickly. And I've listed here the vaccines that are in use today that fall under these categories. So for viruses, one of the ways you can make a vaccine is by using a live virus that has been weakened. Now, the advantage of a live virus is it actually get in your body and multiply a little bit. And so you're going to have a real good immune, strong immune response to that kind of thing. The way we weaken viruses so they don't actually cause disease is by growing them for many, many generations in animal cells so that they're not really adapted to surviving in a human, or to grow them at a different temperature than your body temperature. And so then when they get inside a human body, they really don't do very well. They divide a few times and then your body will take them out. So that's one way to do a viral vaccine. Another way is to do what's called an inactivated vaccine, where you actually grow up lots of the virus and then you treat it with formaldehyde or some other chemical that's going to inactivate it, purify that all away and put it in. So your body's seeing the virus but seeing a dead version of the virus when it comes into your body. And then a recent development, which has been pretty exciting in making viruses, is that you can make viruses just using using parts of the viruses, using recombinant DNA technology. And so what you're doing here is just showing your body one of the shapes that's on the outside of the pathogen without seeing the whole pathogen at all. And that's been a great development in vaccine making. Now, for bacteria are far more complicated than viruses. The most complicated virus has about 200 proteins that it makes, whereas a typical bacteria, something like 3,000 or 4,000 different proteins, is sometimes more. This is the bacteria that causes pertussis here in this picture. So the way we make vaccines for bacteria now is to, and all the currently used bacterial vaccines use parts. So they use recombinant technology to just see part of the bacteria, one of the shapes that's on the surface of the bacteria. So you can just use the sugar that coats the outside of the bacteria. You can use, in the case of tetanus and diphtheria, inactivated bacterial toxins. So you're not even looking at a shape of the bacteria at all. It's not the bacteria that makes you sick. It's a toxin that the bacteria produces. So that's what's used, just the shape of the toxin. And then for pertussis, you can use particular bacterial proteins. Okay, so winning approval for a vaccine requires years of work and a lot of money and time. And the vaccine is first developed, it's then tested in animals, it's then tested in small populations of humans, and all the way studies are being done to make sure it's safe, and eventually it's tested on a large number of people, and the results are monitored. And vaccines are also tested with all the existing vaccines. So any new vaccine has to work with the vaccines that we already have in place. I'll just give you one example of this process from a recently approved vaccine for the rotavirus. It was approved in 2006. The process took over 16 years, $1 billion, and over 70,000 people received that injection before that vaccination before it was approved. So it's not trivial to get a vaccine approved for use. Now, that leads us to the question, are vaccines safe? The simple answer is yes. And let me say why. First of all, hundreds of millions of vaccines are given each year in the United States with no serious complications. Worldwide, billions of vaccines are given around the world with no serious complications. Vaccination is not something we don't have a lot of data on. We have enormous amounts of data. There is a large safety structure in place that monitors vaccine safety. So the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, any person who has a vaccination and thinks they're having a reaction to the vaccination is invited to and encouraged, this is, goes for health professionals and people taking the vaccines, to report those adverse events to this agency. That agency then works with the Vaccine Safety Data Link, which actually has data on people that have received vaccinations all over the country, and to see if there's any link between certain condition that somebody might be concerned about and a particular vaccination. And then there are these clinical assessment centers that also do some of that kind of data sharing and work to look at large numbers of the population. And then the FDA and the CDC, Center for Disease Control, are overseeing the work. So not only is it a hard process to get a vaccine approved, vaccine safety is constantly monitored. Maybe I should just say about that, and we know the system works. There was a vaccine that was pulled about a decade ago, maybe 15 years ago, and they determined it was causing a problem in 1 in 10,000 people who took the vaccine, that was enough to pull the vaccine. So the system does actually work, and it's been used in the not-too-distant past to pull a particular vaccine. Okay, so what are some common concerns about vaccines? I'm going to go through a few of the most common concerns, and then again, in the question time, if I didn't answer your concern, you can certainly ask it. We'll start with the first one. We do not know the effect of giving so many vaccines at once. I was on vacation earlier this summer, and one of our relatives said, well, they've never done a study that shows whether we can take all these vaccines at once. That's not true. Before a vaccine can be approved, it has to go through what's called concomitant use studies. And they've been required for decades. So there are hundreds of studies that show that multiple vaccines can be given at the same time. No new vaccine can be approved if it does not pass these tests. So that's the answer to the first question. Second question, too many vaccines will overwhelm or weaken the immune system or cause allergies or chronic diseases. I'm a parent, and I know when our first daughter started to go in for the vaccines, and my wife is telling me about the schedule and all that they're asking, I was uneasy. And I think it's natural. I mean, do you really want to inject my little girl with all these different things at once? Well, it's helpful to understand a little bit about how the immune system works. Here's the current schedule for recommended immunizations from 0 to 6 years of age. So you see the list of different vaccines, and most of them are given in multiple doses. And all told, if you go through the whole list, you should have 14 vaccinations for 14 different diseases. It's about 26 different inoculations and as many as 5 at once. So boy, that seems like a lot. Is that dangerous for our children? Well, let me give you a little perspective on this. And I think this is helpful. Remember, we said that the issue for your immune system is responding to particular antigens, right? Shapes that are on the invading pathogen. Back when the smallpox vaccine was the only vaccine, it was made from a whole virus, has about 200 different antigens. So in 1900, that was the only vaccine that was around, and people were exposed about 200 antigens. In 1960, we added a few more vaccinations. Here's the pertussis whole cell. This is a whole bacteria, a killed bacteria, 3,000 different antigens there. So now the total of challenges to your immune system in terms of different antigens is over 3,000. Going into even 1980, the challenge is still over 3,000. Now they've dropped the smallpox vaccine. And I know you can't quite see the numbers here, but today, because most of these vaccines are made from parts, just one or two antigens from a particular pathogen, that's all your body's seeing. The total number of antigens from all the vaccines you're given are 142 to 250, depending on which particular, in some of the vaccines you've got choices which one you want to take. So the actual fact is that the challenge to your child's immune system from all the vaccines combined is trivial compared to what they experience in the course of life. I think some studies say a kid could tolerate 100,000 vaccines at once. I mean, that's the way your immune system is designed in terms of number of different challenges and the antibodies that you have. A child who eats a handful of dirt, as this one is doing, is going to be exposed to far more antigenic challenges than all the vaccines that he will take in his entire life. The studies that have been done on this, at this point, there is no evidence that children who are vaccinated are more susceptible to other diseases, to chronic diseases, or to allergies. All right, what about this one? Vaccines cause autism. How many people in this room have heard that vaccines cause autism? Raise your hands high. Okay. Every hand really should be raised because this has been much in the news. Let me tell you why people think vaccines cause autism. Well, one reason is because, and please, if you have an autistic child, I am not trying to trivialize this at all. We've got some folks in our congregation, and I know that this is a huge challenge, so I'm not trivializing this at all. The fact is, we don't really know what causes autism. And whenever there's a condition that we don't really understand, there's a tremendous temptation to try to find an explanation. And so vaccines have been one among a variety of things that have been questioned. Let me tell you a little history on this. In 1998, a British researcher who was also a medical doctor named Andrew Wakefield published an article in The Lancet, a medical journal, claiming there was a link between the MMR, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, and autism. And the basic idea was that that the measles vaccine was damaging the intestines, allowing foreign proteins to get into the brain, and that was then causing autism. And this was his connection. Unfortunately, this paper doesn't demonstrate that, but Mr. Wakefield found some willing journalists. And he sort of went right to the press, and this made a huge splash. Now, what happened subsequently was Wakefield's claims could never be substantiated by any other researchers looking at this question. And in fact, since then, multiple studies involving hundreds of thousands of children have shown that a child who receives the MMR vaccine is no more likely to be diagnosed with autism than one who had not been vaccinated. A subsequent investigation revealed that Wakefield had falsified data, failed to disclose financial conflicts of interest. He was being, in part, financed by trial lawyers representing parents of autistic children. And he'd violated numerous ethic rules, actually, in the way he had handled his subjects in his study. In 2010, his license to practice medicine in Great Britain was revoked. He moved over to the United States, not to practice medicine, but to continue his studies. So in 2010, his paper was formally retracted. The paper originally had 12 co-authors on it, and very quickly the other co-authors dropped off the paper, and then eventually the journal itself completely retracted the paper. Sadly, Wakefield's work did have an effect. These are immunization rates in England and also the rates of measles. So in red, you see before Wakefield's work, something close to 95% of the population was getting the measles vaccination. And then in the time following his paper, the vaccination rates dropped down into the 80s. Now, that might seem like a big deal, but for a very, very highly contagious disease, it is a big deal. And so what happened is while measles cases were humming along around 100 or less, they have spiked up so that in 2008, there were close to 1,400 measles cases in Great Britain. Let me talk about another hypothesis related to autism and vaccines. So in 1999, another hypothesis emerged, sort of going on in parallel with the stuff with Dr. Wakefield. This hypothesis linked autism to thimerosal, an ethylmercury-containing preservative. Here you see a statement actually from the FDA about thimerosal in vaccines. And what happened was, and actually, as you can see here in this statement, thimerosal has been used as an additive to biologics and vaccines since the 1930s because it is a very effective in killing bacteria used in several vaccination and in preventing bacterial contamination, particularly in open multi-dose containers. Some but not all the vaccines routinely recommended for children in the United States contain thimerosal. So the idea is here, it's a cost-effective way to give vaccines. You have a vial that has 10 doses in it and a rubber stopper on it. And so you go in and out of that thing 10 times, always with a fresh syringe, so that's sterile is not an issue. But there's always a chance that there's going to be cross-contamination. And so thimerosal, which contains some mercury, is in there to prevent cross-contamination, so you're not getting some bacterial disease mixed in with the vaccine. And it had been used since the 1930s, and no one had thought anything about it. But more recently, in the 90s, people realizing that mercury poisoning is an issue, and that if there are high levels of mercury that build up in a person, that can cause nerve damage. So the idea was, well, maybe this is tied to autism. Now, what happened was the FDA, based on some concerns like that, basically pulled thimerosal from most of our vaccines. That happened in 2001. And they did that very precipitously before they'd actually done the research. And as a result, many people came away thinking, well, see, the government's admitted there's something wrong with thimerosal in these vaccinations because they pulled it. Well, they pulled it because some people raised concerns, but they hadn't done the studies. I've already said this. So what happened when they did the studies is they started to see that there really was no evidence that there was a problem. One of the things that people are confused about is that the mercury in the environment is methylmercury, a slightly different form than that which is in the vaccines. And the type that's in the environment typically it breaks down much more slowly in the human body. Ethyl mercury, which is the form that was used in vaccines, is eliminated from the body much more rapidly and easily. Nonetheless, as I said, it was removed from most of our vaccines in 2001 in the United States. But subsequent studies have shown no connections between thimerosal and health risk. And these studies have involved upwards of like 500,000 people who have taken these vaccines. Just to give you an idea, a newborn baby typically will ingest something like 2 times the amount of methylmercury than is contained in a typical vaccine, which of course has ethyl mercury instead. So which is contained in all the vaccines that a kid might use. So the amount that we're talking about is really trivial. Let me show you just one of these studies that I mentioned. So in Denmark, they looked at all the children diagnosed with autism between 1971 and 2000. And so you see here it's going along, and they've broken it up by age, but the numbers are low. And then, of course, we get in the 90s, there's been a precipitous increase in autism diagnoses, and not just in Denmark, but in the United States, around the world. Well, in Denmark, they had actually removed thimerosal from their vaccines back in 1992. So you see that the rise in autism is not related to this component in vaccines. It's probably due to the changing definitions of what autism is, because it wasn't until the early 90s that the American Psychological Association manual came up with a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. So instead of the most severe type of autism, now there were milder forms of autism that were also being diagnosed with autism. And there's still people doing a lot of work on this issue, but it's not clear at all whether we actually have more autism now than we had before, or just more autism diagnoses than we had before. Okay, so vaccines, at this point, there is no evidence that vaccines are linked to autism. Finally, how about this one? Vaccines contain harmful ingredients like mercury or aluminum. And I've already dealt with the mercury one with the thimerosal. But let me just talk a little bit about aluminum. Maybe some of you have heard that aluminum's in vaccines. We could spend an hour just talking about some different components of vaccines that people have had problems with. I'll just say a little bit about aluminum here. Aluminum is in a salt form in some of the vaccines, and it's used as an adjuvant to improve the immune response. It's not used in the weakened live viruses because you get a real nice immune response to a live virus. We don't make it quite as good a response to a killed virus and some of these other partial viruses or vaccines. So this is an adjuvant that boosts the immune response. It's been used for nearly 80 years in vaccines. So we have a lot of history on this issue. The amount of aluminum in vaccines is negligible. And there's no evidence that anyone's ever produced that aluminum levels in vaccines are dangerous. Let me just show you one example of this. This is a chart showing how much aluminum, aluminum is like the third most abundant element on the earth, right? So I've seen people say, I envision an aluminum-free world. There's no such thing. Go to another planet if you want aluminum-free world. It's in all kinds of things. It's in our bodies. It's in our food. It's in all kinds of things. So the amount of aluminum a child would get in the first 6 months of life from breast milk would be about 10 milligrams. If you formula feed, about 40 milligrams. If you soy formula feed, about 120 milligrams. The amount of aluminum you get from all the vaccines you take in the first 6 months of your life, 4 milligrams. So it's not really a significant issue. In fact, if you take two antacids, you're getting something like 50 times the amount of aluminum in all the vaccines combined. So just one dose of antacid is going to swamp that. So again, it's a trivial amount. And this is important to realize. It's a fundamental principle in chemistry. It's the dose that makes the toxin. You realize people die from water poisoning. If you've read that, right? You drink too much water, it can kill you. It's the dosage that makes something a poison. It's not necessarily the chemical in and of itself. And this is a chemical that's at very low levels. Are there other components in vaccines that make them unsafe? And the answer is, at this point, we don't have any evidence that there are any other links or problems with vaccine components. And I might say a little bit more about that later. Well, let's talk now about how effective vaccines are. And I'm just going to really focus in on one particular example. We'll talk about measles. Measles is a highly contagious disease. It causes a fever, rash, cough, really high fever, often can be as high as 105 degrees. It can have complications. I think there's something like 30% of the cases, there are some complications. Some of the more severe complications are pneumonia, encephalitis, blindness, and even death. There are over 20 million cases of measles a year around the world. In 2010, there were over 139,000 deaths worldwide. Now, most of those deaths are in the developing world. But before global vaccination was available, measles was killing 2.6 million people, mostly children, a year. In the United States, measles was affecting about 500,000 people a year pretty consistently. When the first measles vaccine was licensed in the 1960s here, measles cases dropped precipitously. The currently used MMR vaccine came into use in about 1971, and so since that second measles vaccine has been licensed, measles cases have been averaging over the last decade something like 60 cases a year, which is to say it's virtually eliminated the disease that was infecting 500,000 people a year. Now, what's interesting is what happens when vaccination rates start to go down. In 2011, there were 222 cases of measles in the United States. So the number's starting to go up. And of those 222, 86% had not been vaccinated. And this really starts to show us what happens when we have a lot of people not receiving vaccines. Earlier this year, there were some visitors to the Super Bowl Village in Indianapolis who contracted the measles. 13 confirmed cases. None of the persons had been vaccinated. Estimates are that something like 100,000 people or more had been exposed. Now, well, why weren't there more cases? There weren't more cases because about 95% of the population is vaccinated. That's why there weren't more cases. But what happens when people are not vaccinated and those people tend to cluster together? That's what happens is that non-vaccinators are not randomly distributed throughout the population. Which would be safer if they were. They're often clustered. And so here's an example of what happens when you get a cluster of non-vaccinated people. In 2005, as a few years back, an Indiana teenager who's unvaccinated returns from a mission trip to Romania carrying the measles. She's starting to feel bad on the plane, doesn't realize what's going on yet. The next day, she attends a church picnic where there are many other people not vaccinated. In the process of visiting with people, she's able to give the disease to 34 people, ages 9 months to 49 years, three of whom had to be hospitalized, one who had to be on a ventilator, and of those 34, only two had been vaccinated. This is what happens when people don't vaccinate. You might have noticed if you're watching the news, there's been a real increase in pertussis cases. And some people are thinking that we may be on the verge of another pertussis outbreak, whereas we had gone for years with something like 1,000 or so cases of pertussis a year to now. We're looking at potentially 40,000 cases this year if we stay on the path we're on. It's not clear that that's all due to non-vaccination. It may be also partly due to the effectiveness of the vaccine. But non-vaccination is a factor. The state with the most cases of pertussis is Washington State, which is also one of the state with one of the highest vaccine exemptor rate in the country. Okay, I'm not going to go through this list with in much detail. Let me just say that if you go on the CDC's website, you can get a list of the schedule, but then also the various diseases that we're vaccinating for. My only point here is to say, if you look down, almost all these diseases are just spread by air, by coughing on somebody. They're spread very easily, and every one of these diseases can have very serious side effects. Even a disease like chickenpox, which some people think, well, we don't need to worry about that. But chickenpox can and has led to encephalitis and pneumonia associated with it. It's not trivial. And many of the others have much more severe potential causes. These are effects. These are also vaccines that are on the list. And again, they're all spread by air, through the mouth, and by direct contact. And again, looking at these, pertussis, the one I was just talking about, can cause pneumonia, and it does kill people. This is what's also known as the whooping cough. All right, well, let's talk now about why vaccines are so controversial. One of the things I want us to realize is that as long as there has been vaccines, there has been an anti-vaccine movement. This is a cartoon that was drawn around the time that Jenner was doing his experiments. And so you see, here's Jenner stabbing his concoction into the arm of this lady. And here's the people that have already been vaccinated, right? They have cow heads growing out of their arms and their mouth and the top of their forehead. And that's what this is. This is an anti-vaccine political cartoon saying that this is insanity to put this cowpox into people's bodies. In the 1720s in New England, Cotton Mather was a Puritan who was a big proponent of vaccination. And he had bricks thrown through his house. His life was threatened. So that this issue has been very contentious since its inception. Let me talk about what's going on here. We have to acknowledge that there have historically been some real risks associated with vaccines. The smallpox vaccine, when they started giving it, it was killing, 2 or 3% of the people that took it. Especially when they were just going from one person to the next. But they reasoned that was an acceptable risk. We don't have that view today. But the point is, there was a risk. Jonathan Edwards died from a smallpox inoculation that ended up killing him. So there have been problems. And I mentioned before that there was a vaccine pulled in the 1990s that was associated with a really rare condition that caused an intestinal blockage. But these things do happen, and thankfully we seem to be able to catch them and identify these problems. Another factor going on here is just a general distrust of, you name it, right? The industry or the government or the doctor. And this is why I've been interested to see that many people in the anti-vaccine movement, this is truly ecumenical, right? Because it bridges people on the far extremes of the political divide. They come together over this issue. But in the issue is often built in this sort of mistrust. And believe me, I'm not telling you we should unskeptically accept whatever anybody tells us. But there's a way in which distrust can lead us to not be thinking clearly about what the actual data says. We don't want to be driven purely by distrust. There's also uncertainty. I'm well aware that there's just tons of bad information out there and confusing information, and it's very hard to know who we should believe. In addition, I think there's complacency. I was talking to a friend of mine who grew up in Africa, and he said for him, being against vaccines would sort of be like being against clean water. They just can't imagine it. And part of the reason is because they've seen these diseases. And one of the problems in our country is the success of vaccines, which has been so great, has actually been their undoing. Because we aren't commonly seeing people with a lot of these diseases around us, and we just don't think that they're really an issue anymore. But they are an issue. They're not just an issue in the United States. They're an issue around the world, and they can travel to the United States. We already talked about the fact there was a rapid increase in the number of vaccines and a corresponding rapid increase in the number of autism cases, and this has gotten many people worried and has fed into this this concern. And then sort of coupled with all of this has been the amount of information that's available on the internet, and then the presence of certain media people and celebrities who have taken a strong position on this. This is my favorite cartoon strip character, Dilbert. And you see here, Dilbert is working, and his pointy-haired boss comes and says, "Someone sent me another anonymous email with a link to an article about the world's worst bosses. I get one of those emails every time I leave your cubicle. Did you think I wouldn't notice the correlation?" And then there's Wally pressing the send button over behind him saying, "Correlation does not imply causation." And this is a fundamental principle. It's so hard for us to get our minds around this. Because when you're vaccinating something like 95% of your population, there is going to be a certain number of people who have a vaccine, who go home, and who manifest some problem. It may have nothing to do with the vaccine. You can only answer that question if you study the data. People who have had the vaccine, people who haven't had the vaccine, and who has this condition and who doesn't. Because two things are linked in time, as this is, does not mean they're linked causally. And a lot of the real momentum and passion in the anti-vaccine movement has come from parents who have children with disabilities, autism, who are absolutely convinced that a vaccine caused the problem, because the first manifestation of the problems followed a vaccine. I read about a researcher who took his child to get vaccinated, to get the DTaP vaccination. The line was so long, he just said, "Forget it, I'm going home, I'll do this another time." And that night, his child died of SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. Now, you can imagine, if he had had the vaccine, it would have been almost impossible to tell him that the vaccine had not caused the death of his child. This situation was really brought home to him because he had narrowly missed having the vaccine, and his child died. Okay, so as I said, the modern anti-vaccine movement began in the early 1980s. At least, the modern movement. It's been championed by parents of children with medical problems, just as I said. And I'm not questioning anybody's motives. But because your child has a problem and it's linked in time with a vaccine does not mean it's linked causally with a vaccine. As we saw in the Wakefield case, journalists willing to publish things and to try to make a story have really exacerbated some of the concerns with vaccines. Now, I know this is going to be hard for some of you to believe, but behind a lot of the anti-vaccine work are trial lawyers. And they have invested enormous amounts of money in these types of things. And that's it's demonstrable. There have also been a number of high-profile celebrities, we'll talk about that a little more in a moment, who've garnered a lot of attention for this issue. If you look on the internet, you see a tremendous number of, you can find lots of anti-vaccine websites. Many of these happen to also be places where people sell supplements and natural medicine. And there's a common link there. There are very few, there are some, and I want to admit that right away, but there are very few medical professionals who are avid anti-vaccine supporters. A couple of well-known folks, Bill Maher, has come out strongly against vaccines and has mentioned that a number of times on his show. Dan Burton was a longtime congressman from the Indianapolis area, has grandsons that are autistic, and he was convinced that it happened because of vaccines. So he actually was sponsoring hearings in the House of Representatives on this issue. Some of the more famous anti-vacciners right now, this is Jenny McCarthy, a former Playmate model, a Playboy model, who had an autistic son. Her boyfriend Jim Carrey has gotten on the bandwagon. They've teamed up with a venture capitalist who also has an autistic son to start an organization that is doing this campaign, Green Our Vaccines. So they're not against vaccines. They just want to clean them up, they say. Their organization's called Generation Rescue. And if you go on their website, you can see what they're all about. Just to give you a little idea, this is a full-page ad they took out in the USA Today, Generation Rescue. Well, see, this is the number of vaccines we were receiving in 1983. This is in 2005. Okay, and then it tells us what the autism rates are. Well, that proves it right there, doesn't it? But it has emotional appeal. And then so here you see mercury, aluminum, formaldehyde, ether, antifreeze. All these things are in your vaccines. Did you know that? The antifreeze one really gets me because antifreeze is ethylene glycol. Vaccines have polyethylene glycol, PEG, which is found in toothpaste, almost all your household things. But that little P makes a little difference in whether you've got a poison like antifreeze or you've got a chemical that's found in almost all household products. Sadly, and whether that's ignorance on their part or just abuse of data, we don't know. But that's the situation. Okay. One of the things we have to realize is that, for those in the back, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. And sadly, there are lots of dogs that are on the internet. And this is a real danger if you're getting your information through the internet. So you have to know your sources. Many sites that are found on the internet, if you search for vaccines, are anti-vaccine sites. The NNII, which I'll give you information on this in a minute, is a site that provides some tips on how to evaluate the credibility of a website. Some tips would include look for a site that has numerous and current scientific studies. Look for a site that has a lack of financial conflict of interest, i.e. they're not trying to sell you a book or a supplement of some sort. A person that actually has experience in this field. And then lack of anecdotes. This is so hard because what you're going to get are the story after story of my healthy little boy got his vaccine and then 2 days later started showing signs of autism. And that's heartrending. But that doesn't make for the kind of analysis that we need to really know if vaccines are causing problems or not. All right, so what's the proper Christian response? I'll try to go quick. When am I supposed to be out of here? When do we have to go pick up our kids? Because I'll have to run out.
11:45.
11:45. Okay, so I'll try to go through and get to some questions here. So a couple of principles. We want to act out of faith and not out of fear. Fear is a very powerful motivator. But we want to try to be acting out of faith. Whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. One of the ways we do this is we get good information. I love King Solomon. He was the wisest man in the world and also a biologist. And he knew his stuff. He knew a lot. And so part of wisdom is getting good information and getting educated. Two key principles for how Christians interact with the world. We love God. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, your strength and your mind. And then I think this other principle, which is this concept that God gives us good things. Now, I think vaccine is a good thing. Vaccination is. And you could argue that it is in terms of public health, next to getting clean water, that this has saved more lives than any other development in human history. And so that doesn't mean we need to uncritically accept this, but it means we need to understand this has been a tremendous blessing to human beings. And it comes from God. And so we need to at least be open to receiving it as a blessing from God. You're also to love your neighbor as yourself, which is the second part of that verse in Luke. All the law is fulfilled in this one word. Paul says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Let me just challenge you a little bit on this. By not vaccinating your child, you're actually putting him or her at risk. The greatest risk that most of your children face when they get a vaccine is that they're going to have a sore spot on their arm or their thigh, and it might be red. They might have a little low-grade fever. For almost everybody, unless there's some kind of an allergy that your child has. But by not vaccinating your child, you're actually putting them at risk, him or her, for a serious disease. And in addition, when you or your child are not immunized, you put others at risk. And it's often the people that are most vulnerable in our population that are put at risk. Part of what's going on here is a concept called herd immunity, which is that if enough people in a population are vaccinated, are protected against a disease, that disease will not spread effectively in the population. And so what that allows is that people that are not vaccinated are allowed to hide in the herd. They're protected because many others are vaccinated. Now, it depends on how contagious a disease is as to how high the immunization rates. Measles, you got to be up in 95% vaccination rate to really keep that to keep the herd immunity in place. Part of what you need to realize is that no vaccine is 100% effective. There are many people who get a vaccination and for whatever reason, their body just doesn't make a good, strong immune response. So people in the population who've received vaccines are not protected. We don't know who we are. But there's some percentage of us not protected. In addition, there are a number of people in the population who cannot be vaccinated. For example, they're a cancer patient. They're on an immunosuppressing drug. For a transplant. They're having to take high levels of steroids. Anything where their immune system is already compromised, they cannot be vaccinated. And they are depending on herd immunity to protect them. And so this is why this is so serious. When healthy children are opting out of the vaccinations, this creates a dangerous situation for everybody else, and especially those people that cannot be vaccinated. Some of our youngest children, we don't give all the vaccines right away. And so some of the youngest children are also in that category of not protected. So herd immunity is an important concept. I think in addition that our witness to the people around us is going to be affected by how we handle this issue. I'm going to try to say this as carefully as I can, but if you are not vaccinating your children because of whatever perceived danger there is, and then are relying on the fact that everybody else in the population is vaccinating their children so that they will protect your children, I don't believe you are acting in a way consistent with loving your neighbor as yourself. In addition, I think if the Christian church, and I know this idea has made inroads in the Christian church, makes a stand against vaccines, we are going to look like we are people easily led astray by bad information and bad ideas. We're going to look like we're anti-science, and I think perhaps even cultish. I think one of the real dangers is that we want to control the externals of our life. I mentioned this the other day. And I know, in my own experience, there's a tremendous temptation for people to get on the internet and to think they can become experts on an idea and try to control every piece of food my kid eats and whether they get the vaccines and all these kinds of things. And I think it's a dangerous, it can swerve into a form of idolatry. And I've seen it happen. And so just a little word of caution. I think this affects our relationship with God and our witness. Now, finally, Dr. Jay Weil is a respected young earth creationist who's written a lot of science textbooks. A lot of homeschoolers use Jay Weil as their science curriculum. Jay Weil says, make no mistake, the facts are crystal clear. Children and adults die or are permanently injured because of the lies of the anti-vaccination movement. If you care about your children and your loved ones, you will carefully investigate this issue. And you can go on his blog. He's got a number of helpful articles. He pulls no punches on this. He is strongly pro-vaccination. All right, we are out of time, so I'll give you this is a list that you have in your outline, and you can use that. You can use that for resources. Let me just say, this man is not explicitly a Christian, but Dr. Paul Offit's written three books that I found very helpful in preparing this. This last book, What Vaccines in Your Child, is very helpful in terms of just, it goes through every single vaccine, has a lot of resources, and this guy's got some helpful things. My final slide just is that we ought to pray for wisdom and to try to encourage one another. All right, I think I could still maybe take 5 minutes of questions. I'm sorry that went long. I think moving the chairs took a little of our time. So I'll try to repeat the question and then go ahead.
I have read on some Catholic websites that some of the vaccines are cultured, for instance, rubella, chickenpox, polio, are cultured in a cell line from an aborted fetus.
That's right.
Electrically aborted from the 1970s.
Yep.
And then I've gone on the CDC website and looked at the information on, for instance, the rubella one, and saw that they have the Wistar and the number, which is, indicates the cell line.
Yep.
And do you have any comments on that?
Okay, this is a great question. This could be a whole topic in and of itself. I'll try to give you a quick answer. So the question is, are some vaccines grown in fetal cells? And the answer is yes. There's about four of them that are grown where the virus is grown in fetal cells. A cell line that came from abortions that were done back in the 1960s. There are two cell lines that were derived that way. I absolutely abhor abortion. I think it's a sin. And the generation of those cell lines was a sin. We are now 50 years downstream, and we're talking about cells that are living in a dish. And so I don't think that there's an ethical problem using the cells that are in the dishes growing at this point. And the Catholic Church itself, I think, has said that they don't see a problem in it. And I think it may even be the current Pope who wrote something to the effect, if everything we use today had to be derived from wherever in the past from completely ethically pure means, we wouldn't be able to use anything around us in a sense. I think that's their position. Do you have a follow-up?
Well, my question is, does that trend, I mean, the fact that more vaccines are proven to spiritual is very recent,
that's a good question. I don't think so. The Rotatec virus vaccine, which is another, the newer Rotatec one, doesn't do that. The HPV one doesn't do that, which is a new virus. I don't think that is a growing trend. Somebody else who's a medical doctor might be able to answer that. That's a good question. Yes. I do think that, yes, I'm not advocating that we have mandatory vaccination. Although, and this is the case today, I think schools have the right then to say, if you won't vaccinate your child, they can't come to my school. I've seen pediatricians who've said, you don't want to vaccinate, find another doctor, because I don't want you putting the people in my waiting room at risk. And I think that works both ways, in other words, what I'm saying. Well, so the question is, should exemption be easier? Because it's very hard to exempt people from vaccines. My position on this is, because if an exemption is obtained because of an ethical or spiritual issue related to your faith, that should be done on the denominational level. So if the RPCNA takes a stance and says, we believe that these vaccines are unethical, and we make a stance, then the people that are a part of our denomination can go and say, this is the position of our church. I'm not as comfortable with every single individual saying, I've got my exemption over here, and I've got my exemption over there. I'm not a huge fan of making exemption easier, although I don't know, I've never tried to get it, so I don't know exactly what's involved. My understanding is in a lot of places it is very easy to get a vaccine exemption. Yeah, and I should say that every one of my kids has received every vaccine that's recommended for them, so I'm not up here telling you to do something that I haven't done. Yes?
Well, it's interesting to us. We've had a condition where this is the seventh year since we've never had a cold, flu, or pneumonia, and when my mom who lived to be 100 years and 6 months, we took care of her for 9 years. When she was talking to the place where she couldn't properly swallow her food, she didn't get her lungs, she never got pneumonia. We started 7 years ago to add essential oil, breathing essential oil, every morning. And since we have been, we've had none of this, and you know, things like lemon, peppermint, cloves, lavender, eucalyptus, they all are antiviral, antitumoral, antibacterial. We found out after she got shingles that geranium is anti-shingles. So it seems like that would be something that should be considered in conjunction with all of this.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on natural medicine. What I can tell you is that natural medicine typically works anecdotally, which is to say what you've just done. You've come in and told us a story about how it works. And I'm not saying that those things can't work. What I'm saying is that vaccination is something that has billions of data points to support it. And so we can say that it works on a broad population level. It's very hard to say that about ginger root and things like that because the studies have never been done. So I'm not against if it works for you. If lemon it works for you, fine. But as a public health policy, you have to go with things that have been tried in the large population, and that seems to work for the population. All right, how about one more, and then I guess I got to get out of here.
You haven't really mentioned any adult immunizations.
That's right.
Flu shots, pneumonia, shingles.
Yep.
Pertussis.
Yep. Quick answer would be, you get your tetanus shot probably, right? So that's one. I think the next time you get your tetanus booster, you should get a pertussis booster, actually, because it looks like it may be that the effectiveness of the vaccine just isn't as good, although it's probably an issue more for adolescents than for older folks, because they switched from using this whole cell vaccine to a parts vaccine, and it may be part of the problem. A flu shot, you should take your flu shot, especially if you're around other people that are vulnerable, young children or elderly people that are sick. There's no side effects unless you have egg allergies, in which case you can't take the flu vaccine, and you're protected against influenza. Influenza is an interesting case because the virus changes every year. So that's one unique situation. We have to get vaccinated every year because the virus is changing. I get those shots myself. Shingles shot I haven't gotten yet, but if you had chicken pox as a younger person, you're vulnerable for shingles, and I would recommend it. All right, thank you guys so much. And I'm sorry we ran out of time.